The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Welcome to the 7th episode of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If you haven't listened to Unsound Methods before, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, technique, process and motivations to write.
In this episode, we speak to a slightly different author, Daniel Levin-Becker. He's an author of non-fiction and also a member of the Alipo, which is a rather bizarre and nebulous organisation based ostensibly in France, but
I think there's members from several countries. The Alipo is pretty hard to define. I think it's something we cover in this episode from the horse's mouth, as it were.
Some of the aspects of the Alipo are an approach to creating not just fiction or writing, but other art forms as well that engage with different rules and approaches.
I think, yeah, using constraints as a way of releasing creativity is a sort of cornerstone of it.
So yeah, we talk to Daniel about his time in Paris with the Alipo and what he learned from that. And now, without any further ado, here's Daniel Levin-Becker.
Hi there, Daniel. Well, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I thought we'd start just by asking you a bit about yourself and your writing and your route into what's quite an interesting journey that you've been on, I guess, literally to France as well as to the Alipo.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's see. I am from Chicago. I learned about the Alipo during my first year in college in a French literature survey course where we read a story by Georges Perec called Le Voyage d'Hiver and a sequel story to it by Jacques Roubaud called Le Voyage d'Hier, or The Winter Journey and Yesterday's Journey. And the professor mentioned, by way of just giving us context about who Perec was, that he had also written a 300-page mystery novel that did not contain the letter E. And as somebody who, totally unaware of this, had about a year and a half prior made a mixtape for himself in which the artist names and song titles did not contain the letter E, I thought this was a remarkable instance of kindred spirithood from beyond the crypt.
What drew you to choosing not to use an E in that case?
I have no idea. I think
just complete randomness.
The challenge of it and the rules, I suppose. I think it wasn't until learning more about the Alipo and what Alipian philosophy is all about that I started thinking about it in terms of rules and choosing the rules that you want to work with. But I think that was probably latently involved in my decision to do that totally pointless thing that I did.
Could you give just a brief overview of the Alipo for the listeners who maybe not familiar with,
sure,
with the organizer?
So the Alipo is a Paris-based collective of writers and mathematicians and scientists. It was started in 1960 by Raymond Queneau and François Le Lyonnais. Queneau was a poet and publisher who just had sort of an extracurricular hobby interest in mathematics. And Le Lyonnais was a chemical engineer who had an extracurricular hobby interest in pretty much everything else under the sun. And the two of them together came up with the idea. I'm already going way too deep into the weeds historically, I realize, but I'll make up for lost time by truncating several other important things down the line, so don't worry. They decided to create this group as sort of a working group to basically a seminar to discuss the history of experimental literature, which was something that was dear to them and influential in their respective sort of artistic, sentimental educations. But pretty quickly, the group became more of a laboratory for people who wanted to create new kinds of experimental literature, and started to revolve around exploring different kinds of constraints, notably, for instance, writing a book without using the letter E, but also more generally structures and how the notion of structure as used in a mathematical sense or a linguistic sense could be abstracted and used to generate more creative work, like literature in the case of the Ulipo, or in the case of other splinter groups that have started since then, like the Ubapo Ba, in that name, standing for bande dessinée, which means cartoon in French, approaching cartooning from a structured, often rule-based perspective. And there's an Umupo for music, there's an Ufopo for photography, and so on. So the overall thrust is kind of exploring what the generative possibilities of rules and structures are for artistic creation.
And did once you started becoming interested in that at college, you said the course you'd done where you found out about Perec, did you find that immediately led to changes in how you yourself wrote? I mean, were you sort of taken with it and immediately started trying to challenge yourself, or were you interested more in what other people were producing?
I think I was interested more in what other people were producing. The osmosis of, you know, those principles into my own writing work were pretty slow to occur, as I recall it now. In college, I was still pretty ensconced in the notion that fiction was the only kind of creative writing that was really accessible to me. You know, I was aware of poetry, but had no idea how to write a poem, much less how to read a poem. And you know, humor writing and other sorts of journalistic writing just didn't feel like creative outlets that were really open. And I think a big part of what I took away from college, in addition to learning about the Ulipo, was discovery of creative nonfiction as a thing. And I think that was, in a way, a more important revelation in terms of my own trajectory as a writer than realizing that, you know, there was this group of French weirdos that also enjoyed these sort of literary parlor games. I think learning that approaching nonfiction from a creative and idiosyncratic perspective really helped me open up some channels between the kind of writing I was already doing and enjoyed doing and the sorts of rule and structure based stuff that appealed to me philosophically.
And is there quite a crossover with it? The Ulipo works that I'm familiar with, I think, are all in heavy sort of inverted commas fiction, but is there does it being creative nonfiction that you might choose to write using constraints, does that add yet another layer of constraint to the production?
It can. I think, you know, constraints in Ulipian practice can be verifiable at the level of, you know, the letters you're allowed to use or the words you're not allowed to use or punctuation. Or there's a novel by Anne Garreta that was translated into English a couple of years ago called Sphinx, in which it's basically, the novel is a love story between two characters whose genders are never revealed. And the constraint that allows you to do that in French is fundamentally different from the constraint that would allow you to do that in English because of differences in grammatical structure between the languages. But that's an example of a kind of constraint that's a little less visible on the page. And there are constraints of production, like procedural constraints. And there are constraints of, you know, you write a haiku every night before bed, and you write 20 lines a day. These are both examples of things that Harry Matthews, who was the other American member of the ULIPO, has done. So approaching nonfiction from a ULIPian standpoint, or approaching ULIPian work from a nonfiction standpoint, I think there's no particularly doctrinaire way that that has to go. I think telling the truth can certainly be a very exacting constraint if you hold yourself to it.
Do you see any difference between sort of searching for a truth when you're writing nonfiction and when you're writing fiction? Is it the same truth that is ultimately you feel underneath both of those, or is there differences, subtle or otherwise, that exist between the sort of truth that you're aiming for?
It's a great question. I think ultimately, man, I don't know how to answer that. I think ultimately it's a similar kind of truth that, you know, unites good fiction with good nonfiction. There's a more trivial kind of truth that separates the two, I guess.
Do you feel you if you sit down in front of a blank page, do you have a sort of nonfiction hat and a fiction hat? You know which you're going to produce, or is it more of a process of discovering as the words go down on the page which you're leaning towards more than the other?
Closer to the former. It's pretty rare that I sit down to write something without knowing the shape that I'm intending for it to be. Which is just, you know, that's a property of my own relationship to production, that, you know, I take a lot of idle notes. But one of the things that's liberating and productive for me about note-taking is that, although you can think of note-taking as a form unto itself, refreshingly liberated from questions of, is this nonfiction? Is this fiction? Mm. You know, only the truth of whatever compelled me to note down this or that observation or snippet of language is what matters.
And what is the turning point or the sort of critical mass where you go from the notes in the notebook or the computer or wherever you've collected the notes to the process of actually starting to create a piece of work? Is there a definite point where you feel, okay, these notes have to turn into something now, or does it depend on, you know, deadlines, say, or other external factors that decide which form you work on?
Again, I wish I had a cleverer answer. I think it's sort of a mixture between the two. It's often a deadline or some external desire that's more formally just a desire to write a certain kind of thing, which will usually come to me as, you know, here's a piece of fiction that I should write. Here's a piece of nonfiction that I should write, that will allow me to go back through the notes that I've taken and do a sort of pattern recognition based on, a certain kind of truth, if you like, or a certain kind of consistency that I'm looking for. An example of something I did recently is I wrote an introduction for a book of erasure poems by a writer in New York named Wendy Walker, who took the text of a Victorian Gothic novel called The Mysteries of Udolpho by Anne Radcliffe and erased everything but one word from each line of the book, and in doing so created this sort of phantasmagoric erasure poem that is also readable as kind of a story of plantation revolt, or at least that's the way that I read it. And so taking notes, reacting to that was a mode of kind of searching for and I hesitate to use the word truth because it's so loaded, but what the sort of unifying response that came out of these smaller notes that I was taking was, and with something like an introduction, I felt very, very welcome to write something that could have been fictional. It could have been very straightforward nonfiction or critical. And what I ended up doing was something that I don't think really falls into either category, but it was nonetheless based on sort of trying to pull together the disparate strands that, you know, as I started to perceive patterns among them, trying to say, here's a point that I want to make, here's a point that I want to make, now how do I want to make that point? Is it sort of an unclassifiable poetic sort of way of relating to the points I want to make and the people who I'm expecting to read the piece, or is it going to be more curatorial? Is it going to be more academic? I'm sort of rambling now, I realize, but I feel like it's at some point during the last paragraph that I spoke, there was some useful stuff.
Yeah, no, that's interesting stuff. I think it gives a good idea of how that process sort of how you work from going from notes to something longer. In that example, for instance, I guess you had some, whether explicit or not, some sort of word count guidelines on how long the introduction should be. Do you generally also have an idea when you, if you're writing more free form fiction, say, or less constrained pieces, do you have an idea when you start writing how long a piece will be, or does that vary quite a lot once you start on the process?
It varies quite a lot. I mean, so certainly, and I think this is an answer I might have given a few questions ago, the constraints of, you know, format, whether it's you're writing a book review and you only have 1200 words, or you're writing a novel and, you know, you could write a 10,000 word novella, or you could write a 1000 page novel. And both of those are sort of unwieldy for commercial reasons rather than aesthetic reasons. Those are all perfectly valid kinds of constraints. But ones that the Ulipo exists in large part to kind of help writers sidestep by focusing on other similarly, I guess, prosaic and practical kinds of constraints, which is to say, you know, if you're trying to write, let's say you're trying to write a short story and you have a general sense that a short story should be about, let's, you know, 3,000 to 6,000 words. And you know that you want it to be published in The New Yorker. And so you have a sense of a certain New Yorkeriness that you're trying to get across. These are, and, you know, you're writing in English, which is your first language, or maybe it's your adopted language, and you're writing it in the present tense, and you are, you know, a white dude, and so you're aware of certain limitations on the voices that you want to be able to, or that you want to try to speak in, all that sort of thing. These are constraints that pretty much always operate on a writer when he or she is, I guess I'll stick with he since I said white dude. When you're undertaking a creative project, there are all of these prejudices and strictures that you are more or less consciously obeying. The fact of the language you're writing in, the fact of the genre and medium that you're targeting. And the idea behind the Ulipo is that there are all sorts of liberties that you're holding yourself back from because you are sort of unconsciously beholden to these rules about convention and length and social niceties. And taking something like a word count, like I have to make this text exactly 3,000 words or exactly 3,000 syllables, or I was talking last week with a member of the Ulipo, Olivier Senon, who recently wrote a text in which a series of texts, 60 texts, in which the letter N could only appear 60 times. He was taking, it wasn't dictation, but somebody that he was writing the text for and with was relating to him these anecdotes. And his job was to take these anecdotes and rewrite them in such a way that the letter N only appeared 60 times per text. And when you do something like that, as much as you're still bound to these other things that are, you know, constraining you, the idea behind Ulippian practice is that by focusing on a rule so simple and so stupid as the certain number of times you can use the letter N, you are not letting you're not giving your mind the space or the bandwidth to focus on any of the other things. You sort of are outsmarting yourself and giving yourself no choice but to express yourself in a way that is more honest, because you're not preoccupied by, is this socially appropriate? Is this New Yorkery enough? Is this text that's becoming of me as a white dude to write? You're just focused on how many times you're using the letter N. And that allows you to unlock a certain liberation that you wouldn't have had access to otherwise. That's the philosophy. It does, you know, I buy it to a certain degree. I think every member of the Ulipo buys it to some degree and, you know, has some reservations about some parts of it, but it's definitely not for anyone. And now I'm going to try to remember what the original question was that I was answering.
Okay, we've moved on by now. It's about,
okay. Could I...
Oh, hey, guys. Didn't see you leave.
Could I ask you a sort of slightly less technical question, but just how... Because we haven't really covered your route into or towards the Ulipo, I guess would be a more interesting way of explaining it. I don't know if this is exactly the right word to use, but as I understood it from many subtle channels, you essentially were recruited as a slave to do some grunt work in terms of archiving someone's library, Perek's library or someone else's, perhaps?
It was the Ulipo, the entire Ulipo's archives. So I moved to Paris at the end of 2006. And I had a research grant. So to say that I was a slave is to kind of gloss over the part where I was being funded by the American State Department to do this research. But nonetheless, I eagerly indentured myself to the Ulipo, and the majority of what I did was helped take these dozens of boxes of documents that had been sitting in Marcel Benabou's house until about a year before and had recently been given to the French National Library to constitute an archive of the Ulipo's work and, you know, internal materials to basically to catalog those, to organize and inventory and in rare cases, curate those documents. And that was something that was a great, obviously a great archival project. It was a great way of encountering the group's history, but I had to supplement it by also making contact with the living, working members of the group. And that was, you know, because I was in Paris and the group is based in Paris, that was sort of the second half of my grant project, was going to readings and having conversations and interviews with the members who were available, and just gradually becoming enough of a hanger-on in my capacity as slave and fanboy to make the Ulipo as a group sort of curious about who I was and where I was coming from and what I had to offer besides my exceptional alphabetical organization abilities.
Were you sort of open about your enthusiasm, or did you kind of Gallic it down a little bit?
Gallic it down?
As in sort of, I imagine in Paris, large expressions of enthusiasm are probably not entirely the way to ingratiate yourself with a group like the Ulipo.
Very true. I suppose I galloped it down a little bit.
I wouldn't want you to think that's an English expression.
You know? I was wondering where you were going.
It's literally never been uttered before.
It's great. I'm going to steal it. I don't know for what.
Was the process of sort of becoming part of the group? Did you find that was easy once you sort of made contact, or how did that process go? Sort of from the sort of initial week of working out what needed to be done archivally to actually building relationships with members in the group.
That all happened, I would say, pretty organically, because it was clear, just given that I was this dude who showed up from the US and was asking for the privilege of toiling in this stuffy archival room with a plant that was not really doing a very good job of staying alive, that, you know, I was enthusiastic and I was eager to learn more, and I just wanted to kind of surround myself by this material. The constraint, I suppose you could say, of those interactions from that time period was one of the bylaws in the ULIPO, which stipulates that anyone who requests or applies to become a member of the ULIPO becomes permanently ineligible for membership.
Which I think makes sense from what they're trying to do. And it's interestingly counterbalanced from what you also say in your book about the fact that it's almost impossible to leave other than on a slab.
Yeah, and even on a slab, you don't get to not be a member of the ULIPO anymore. That's the more famous of the bylaws, is that you can neither quit nor be kicked out, and dead members are still considered members unless they have committed suicide with the express and exclusive intent of leaving the ULIPO and doing so in the presence of a notary. I think it's obviously a very silly, tongue-in-cheek bylaw, but there is a sort of serious merit to it. But knowing this and having distance fantasies of one day becoming a member of this group that had so radically kind of opened up my perceptions of what literature could do and could be, but also knowing that I had to play it cool, that I had to Gallic it down at every turn, I don't want to over-dramatize it, because it's not like I was constantly stifling my outpourings of ambition and enthusiasm. I think it was, it was just a year, 2 years really, of getting to know people and getting to know, trying to answer the question, which was the chief reason that I wrote Many Subtle Channels. The question that really animates it is, who are these people? You know, there's a lot that had been written about sort of the literary and philosophical import of the ULIPian mode of production and how it's indebted to various pre-existing cultural movements, and how it is and isn't an offshoot of surrealism, and what it has to do with mathematics and all of that. But there was a human element that was missing. And what I wanted to know, as much as whether it would be possible for me to become a member of the group, was, in a sense, what kind of person did it already make me, just because I was interested in this? You know, was I totally fascinated by the idea of writing a book without the letter E, only to then find that all of the people who were also fascinated in it were complete sociopaths? Or was it, a group of people who were and are in many ways like me, with a lot of similar preoccupations and a lot of similar neuroses, and the people that I could sort of imagine getting to know better and work with and eventually sort of take on as a second family? Spoiler alert, it was the latter.
Nous espérons que vous appréciez cet épisode. N'oubliez pas d'aimer et de vous abonner.
You mentioned earlier that when you entered college, you had your sort of literary sensibility was mainly focused around fiction, or solely focused around mm-hmm. fiction, and you sort of gradually opened your eyes more to nonfiction. Was the process of working with the Aleppo and being in France, was that a significant part of that sort of move to nonfiction? And were there any specific works or people that kind of gave you an epiphany of now I see what nonfiction can be? Or was it more a sort of gradual process as you were sort of reading and learning more?
The revelation about nonfiction was something that happened in college, in a class that I took with a writer named Anne Fadiman, who, you know, was a wonderful teacher, is a wonderful writer, and just sort of showed by example and by filling out a really well curated syllabus for the course, and you know, giving us good assignments, sort of just demonstrated what the way in which creative nonfiction could be a phrase that actually holds together logically. That, you know, nonfiction, even though it is technically true and has allegiance to, you know, presenting events as they've really happened or really been experienced, could still be weird and could still be lavishly descriptive and, you know, unified by a really gonzo or idiosyncratic voice or perspective. And so the way the Aleppo came into all of that for me was just through the process of writing this book about it. That was, you know, it was the first book I wrote. It was the first it was the first nonfiction project I'd done of any, you know, really considerable length, I guess, besides, you know, college papers of 50 pages or so. And it was, you know, there. When I say that the Aleppo helped me, maybe after the nonfiction revelation opened the doors to other kinds of writing than fiction being creatively fruitful. When I say the Aleppo helped continue that opening, some of it is through essays. For instance, Perec has a really wonderful book called Species of Spaces that's just about different kinds of space. It's not especially constrained in any overt ways, but it's just, you know, it's a kind of writing that's really sumptuous and relatable and generous. And but there are also things that are sort of poems and sort of unclassifiable, that kind of take the guise of nonfiction or take the guise of poems or even take the guise of novels that just don't really subscribe, don't really honor or valorize traditional distinctions between, you know, this is fiction, this is not fiction. I know I'm rambling again, but I guess the exciting part of the Aleppo as a channel through which to really kind of not come into my own, but really like inhabit nonfiction as a genre that I wanted to write in, was just giving me this massive wealth of information and description and characters and just things that I thought were really fascinating and strange and troubling in some cases, and just trying to find a way of pulling it all together into something shareable. And whether that was something I was going to do using a system of constraints, whether it was something I was going to do totally turning my back on constraints, because a constrained book about constraint is sort of, you know, I've seen it done very preciously. I've seen it done very well also, but it wasn't necessarily the route I wanted to take. Asking these questions about how to take the subject matter and put it into a package that does it justice and also kind of explores the creative potential of of the subject matter itself. God, this is a terrible sentence, and I don't even know when it started.
No, I mean, I wanted to sort of ask you, related to that, with many subtle channels, because it seems it's reasonably conventionally structured, but at the time I was reading it, and this is something I think you allude to, I was starting to think, oh, is there a sneaky constraint hidden in here somewhere that I've not yet picked up on? And I'm sure some other people have asked you about that. But I suspect there isn't a constraint in there at all. It's not, you're not really playing tricks with it. Am I right in that?
I mean, my official stance is that I have no official stance on that question.
But does it make you, I mean, you, as someone who had already composed a mixtape with titles that didn't have the letter E in and was really drawn to this, are you a sort of a natural pattern seeker? Do you think you end up finding constraints that are unconsciously present in things?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, you know, I think that's one of the, beyond the kind of literary pedigree of the Ulipo and the academic relevance and the scholarly, you know, cerebral qualities that it has to offer people who are interested in that sort of thing, I think one of the most special things that this style of writing and of reading has to offer is that, is a way of kind of indulging the suspicion that I have and that I think a lot of people share, that there are patterns to be found in things, whether or not they were put there intentionally is sort of ultimately immaterial, because if you find them, if the pattern is meaningful to you, then there's no use in trying to argue that it's not really there.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that the Ulipo is obviously drawn together by the members are people that are drawn to this sort of way of thinking and do tend to see patterns and things and respond to those sort of constraints to write more creatively or act more creatively in whichever field they're working in. But you also mentioned that most of the members also have some reservations about that approach and their limits for each individual and where they feel that can sort of lead them. Do you have any sort of specific reservations that you can talk about in terms of where you feel that approach falls short, where you need to sort of step beyond it to get something, to get something more powerful or more truthful?
That's another good question. I think in my own work, and you know, there's not actually that much of my own work to date that is work that's you know, considerable in scope and also really constrained all the way through. You know, it's something that I enjoy writing about as much as I enjoy writing under. But I think, to me, constraint is most useful as, is most universally useful as scaffolding rather than the building itself, which is to say that I believe, in a way that certain members of the Ulipo don't, that the constraint serves you generatively and, you know, as a tool against writer's block for as long as it serves you. And then there's no need to maintain your allegiance to it if it makes the piece that you're working on suffer, or if it makes your experience of writing suffer.
Going back to what you were saying about the sort of note-taking phase and then a period before you start writing the piece in earnest, where you're note-taking or looking at patterns, would you say the constraints are most useful at that phase, at the earlier stage when you're conceptualizing the topic or just gathering notes, gathering information, as opposed to sort of later on where you're maybe forming the piece?
In practice, I would say it's sort of it's the place between note-taking and beginning to draft in earnest. Like, the note-taking feels very free and associative and self-indulgent, and you know, I'm seldom happier than when I'm just taking notes on something. That's that would be a great thing to put on a dating profile. I think the pattern recognition and sort of Oulipian architect in me is most active when I'm trying to decide how to pull the notes together into something, like what to build out of them. And I'm, you know, because the notes are unruly and I don't want the thing that they're going to become to be unruly. And so I kind of let my mind go as crazy as it needs to in terms of thinking about structures that might be useful. But then to the point that I was making a moment ago, more often than not, there's a time when I say, you know, this structure has helped me take these notes and find a pattern among them, put them into different boxes and find a sequence between the boxes. And then I can let it go. Not always, you know, sometimes it's a constraint or an organizing principle that feels like it needs to be present for the reader to get the benefit of it. But not always.
Hmm. With the, I just wanted to ask about, obviously you spent some time in France, so you'll be more familiar with the culture there than I am. But do you think there's a reason that France is the breeding ground for this kind of innovation? Or do you think this could have just sprung up anywhere? It just happened to be France.
I think, well, the Oulipo itself, I don't think could be anything but French, which seems like an extremely tautological answer, and in some ways is. But there are, you know, there are traditions in other cultures that have kind of taken up similar ideas and similar approaches to language and creation. What I think is uniquely French about the Oulipo is, first of all, the way in which it is a formal and closed membership society. And when I say it's a society, it's like technically it's an association according to French law. It has, you know, it has members and it has bylaws and it has tax things that it can and can't do. But it's, you know, it's a group that has, that you're either a member of or you're not a member of. And it has rules around who is included and who is excluded. It has a very rigorous schedule of monthly meetings, and each meeting has a very rigorous agenda. And it has protocols in a way that, you know, if you spend even a little time in France, you start to kind of intuit the way that the passion for protocol is just sort of something that feels like it's in the drinking water there. The other very French thing about not the group itself so much as the approach is, you know, not personally being a product of the French education system. I can only say this as an observer, but I think the way that French is taught, with such an emphasis on rules, and you know, there being a correct way to do something, and there being all these rules that you have to learn, and all these exceptions to the rules that you have to learn, and you know, like the French language is really sort of a wonderland of rules and exceptions, maybe even more so than English is. And I think the educational system really kind of brings that out, and it feels very natural to me that there should be this mentality that arises whereby both honoring and subverting those rules is kind of the maximally interesting thing you can do with language. That, you know, you love the language and you show that by knowing its rules so well that you can break them elegantly or subversively, or in any case with great passion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of interesting that it might be something inherent to French language and education. I think that's something
that's I mean,
sorry, carry on.
Just that's my sense of it, and you know, I'm sure it's wrong in some important ways, but that's how I.
But I wonder how with in state education in Britain, certainly when I was doing it, the idea that I think we probably had one afternoon in English where we did grammar, and then the rest of it is Shakespeare and Charles Dickens, and I didn't know what it did.
Right, and like I was a terrible student of grammar when I was learning, you know, when I had English classes in school, and I didn't actually start to learn, much less enjoy grammar, until I started really learning French in earnest.
And I
think that's as much about learning a second language as it is about mm-hmm. French in particular. But I think, you know, when you know, if you have a French 14-year-old and an American 14-year-old in US, you expect one of them to know what a gerund is. It's probably going to be the French one.
And do you remember at what point you sort of realized fiction or writing in general was a thing, so to speak, that whether at school or what sort of impetus was there for you to start pursuing writing and to become interested in the topic of fiction initially and then nonfiction?
You know, I really don't. I think I was always drawn, maybe not always, but sort of the earliest recollection I have about a relationship to language as such is just really loving words and really loving the texture of some words and the way they can be used to describe things. And in sort of a maybe an unimaginative way, which is to say, you know, thinking that now as the insuperably wise person that I am, looking back at the insuperably dumb kid that I was, you know, somebody who really liked words and what they could do. Seems like that kid should have probably started with poetry and gotten really into the economy of words and the way that, you know, each word has its own sort of spooky action, as it were. But I found fiction to be, you know, the place where, you know, I read more fiction than poetry as a kid, and knowing about novels and short stories as places where things got described interestingly and words got used in powerful ways, I think was the locus of that sort of.
Would you say it's a similar motivation? Are you similarly motivated nowadays when you write? Is it that sort of love of words and the textures and the spooky qualities that some words hold compared with others that motivates you to write? Or are there other elements that are stronger nowadays?
That's still there for sure. It's in a way, I think I've started writing as much about that as through it. Like, it's sort of the things that I find myself drawn to writing about are uses of language in that way, as much as the writing I want to do is a vehicle for it. That's inarticulate in a manner ill befitting somebody who's just talking about how great words are. But
what are you working on at the moment? Are you working on another longer project or just short things?
I'm working on a few. I'm sort of wrapping up a volume of Ulippian work in translation with Ian Monk, who is the only active English member of the group, who's also a translator. The two of us have selected and translated just over 50 texts, one by each member of the group, at least one by each member of the group, and we're putting together a sort of sampler anthology of pieces that kind of the intent is to give a richer sense of the breadth and diversity of the Ulipo in terms of its members and its approaches than has been available to this point, which is to say, you know, if you're a reader of Ulipian work, you probably know Perec and Cano and Calvino and Harry Matthews, maybe, but there are, at this point, there are 37 other members of the group, myself included, who each, you know, each of us incarnates the group in a kindred but different way. And a lot of that doesn't exist in English. And so we feel like there's sort of a little bit of a myopia critically in terms of the way that
sort of focus on a fairly narrow band of writers, I guess. Yeah. When's that?
Yeah. So this is an attempt to just kind of provide a groundwork for encountering more.
And
more
when's that due to be out?
Likely by the end of next year.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we've taken up a bit of your time here, and we're sort of pushing on over an hour now. So, it might be a good point to sort of wrap up. I don't know if there are any places online that people can find out more about you or your work, and social media or websites you want to mention.
that I want to plug. Let's see. My personal website is dinnerlunchbreakfast.com. And my Twitter handle is DLB.
That's all easy to remember.
Keen readers and listeners. The pattern there. And the Ulipo's website is Ulipo, Ulipo.net. It is almost entirely in French, but resources for finding out more about the group are not too hard to come by in English. I guess I should also plug my book, which is called Many Subtle Channels in Praise of Potential Literature, which is available from Harvard University Press and wherever fine books or shaving utensils are sold.
Great.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. It was really interesting to hear about your experiences. And I look forward to seeing the compendium of translations.
Yeah, great to speak to you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Bye, sir. Cheers. Bye.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Thank you to Daniel Levin-Becker for joining us all the way from the United States of America. So that was episode 7. Thanks for listening. Do remember to like and subscribe, and follow us online at unsignedmethods.co.uk or on Twitter at unsignedmethods.
You can follow me on Twitter at Jamie Batchen, or my website is jamiebatchen.com.
And you can find me at lachlanbloom.com.